everybody. Welcome to the New Glarus Brewing Company podcast. This is Catherine May. I am here today with Scott May, doing a little bit something different. Scott has been interviewing our team and Dan Carey and members of our community for the New Glarus Brewing Company for over 70 episodes. So you know a lot about Scott May, but we haven't been able to kind of dive into Scott, what makes him think, how he works, how he does his magic. So I thought we would have fun today and be able to interview Scott. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing really good, actually. I woke up and just like a fabulous mood this morning. Like I looked at my Apple Watch and it was the first time in over a year I got over 8 hours of sleep.
All right.
This I was really stoked.
This is a good day for this then. We'll see what pops out of this episode then, all the magic. So Scott, I'm excited to do this because when you interview other people, I think people have been able to kind of learn about your personality, but they may not know a lot about what how you got here, kind of the path you've taken. And I find it really interesting. So you have a Bachelor's of Science for English Literature from Edgewood College here in Madison.
Go fighting eagles.
And you worked at the state capitol in Madison, helping bills get passed, working to get people elected on the campaign trail. Before that, I know that you had a lot of kind of oddity jobs. I think you worked as a pony operator. I think you delivered donuts once. You're a short order cook.
I was a cook for a very long time. Like that was like the longest job I ever had. I think it might still hold the record of longest job I've ever had.
So then I kind of want to talk about this of how, you know, what the path is that leads from this junction from there's this point where, you know, you're kind of doing manual labor kind of jobs. And then you end up going to college, getting this writing degree and then working at the Capitol. And then you're here. So it's kind of this weaving stream of a path that I find really interesting. So I'd like to kind of dive into that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of Scott May, maybe like circa 2005, somewhere in there?
Oh yeah, sure. 2005 it was a cool year for me actually, because like I think I graduated in 2006 from college. So I was in 2005, I would have been 22 or 23. So still, oh no, I'd have been older than like 24 or 25. So still a little long in the tooth to be, you know, going into my junior year of college, but I was sort of drifting too at the same time. I was working 40 to 50 hours a week in a kitchen. I was doing, I was a full-time student, so I was, you know, I had four or five classes most of the time, and most of my classes were a hardcore at that point, 400 level English lit classes. So it would be no joke. Like at the beginning of a semester, I would buy all my books because I always wanted to keep them. You know what I mean? And I would look at my kitchen table, and each class I would have 12 or 13 books to read. So my table would just be like full of like 50 books that I'd have to get through in the next like 3 months on top of cooking, on top of sort of starting to stress out a little bit about what I was going to do after all of this was over. But it was kind of fun because like my whole life was just so scheduled of like, get up, read, go to class, go to the library, read, go to work for 6 hours, go home, drink and read, go to bed, repeat. You know, that was basically my whole life. And when I look back on it, I sort of miss those times in the library where all I had to do was read like these next 50 pages. And then I could like treat myself to reading People magazine or something like that, you know? And that's what I would do. I'd read like the gossip rags after reading like this heavy literary stuff. And it just felt like a cool balance in my
evens
life.
It out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then what led you, like when you're talking about graduating from school, so you get your degree, and then what leads you to working at the state capitol? Because when we met, that would have been about 2012, I want to say, you had just gotten your job at the Capitol.
Yeah, my first full-time job in the Capitol, yeah.
Yeah.
So
what made you want to work there? Like what kind of things did you do there and what did you find? Well, 'cause you did it for over a decade.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I did it from basically 2008. It was when I got my first internship was in the week of Christmas, 2008. And I left the Capitol in 2020, I believe, to, you know, during the height of the start of the COVID stuff is when I ended up leaving the Capitol. But, you know, when I was like in fourth grade, they, you know, they asked you what, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? That sort of thing. I had watched, I was weird. I was like really into watching the news. So like, I'd watched news coverage of the, you know, the LA riots. I'd watched news coverage of the first Gulf War. And I think it was during the time of the first Gulf War, I saw Ted Kennedy give a speech on the floor of the Senate. And that guy was just like, he was known as the Lion of the Senate. So he's very much like one of those fist pounding kind of, you know, firebrand Massachusetts Democrats with the name Kennedy. And I remember going into fifth grade and telling my teacher I wanted to be either wanted to be a cook because I was really into the Frugal Gourmet and Yen Ken Cook on PBS, or I wanted to be a United States Senator. And so, you know, I've always sort of had that in the back of my head. And then like, you know, I think in like, as a freshman in high school, Illinois was circulating a bill to push the driving age to 18. And I organized my friends to like write letters to the governor, you know, shit like that. And I was just always been kind of, you know, kind of a, I like causing a stink. So I like when I can kind of fight, you know what I mean? So I was always sort of into politics. So when I was starting to, when I was in my senior year in college, my mom actually had moved up to Wisconsin from Illinois a couple years prior and went to Edgewood to get her MBA. She'd been a, you know, a county health nurse and a renal nurse for my whole life. And then she moves up here and decides to go for her master's of business administration. And one of her classmates worked for a Republican in the state capitol. She worked for a Republican state senator. She's a great person. Her name is Jen Esser. And she said, mom was sort of lamenting, what is my son going to do with his Bachelor of Science in English Literature after he gets out? And she said, well, what's he into? And she said, well, he's always sort of been into politics. And she was like, well, why don't we get him an internship in the Capitol and see if he likes it? And she's like, well, he's kind of a liberal, you know, kind of a Democrat. And she's like, ah, that's cool. I, you know, Erpenbach, who was a state senator at the time, she's like, I'm good friends with all his crew. I will, you know, say, hey, I got this kid. He puts in an application. You meet him. That's all you got to do. And I did. And they met me. I just met a guy named Trigg and Trigg Knudsen. He was awesome. He was John's chief of staff forever. And he was just like, you want to work for free? You can write? Okay. And that was it. And I started. And what I soon discovered is I don't have a lot of skills, but the skills I have in communication and being able to write and being able to take complicated things and then present them succinctly is very useful in the Capitol, because you can trip over a policy expert walking down those halls. Like, I'm the education guy. I'm the healthcare guy, and no shade to those people. You need them. But at some point you need someone who can say, here's how it works for, you know, just some guy on the street. You know what I mean? And that's what I could bring to the table, is I could condense things. And also it's really useful to have someone who can edit. So, you know, like, you don't look too dumb when you're sending stuff to the press. That's how, you know, public health committee becomes pubic health committee and no one has a good day. It's a long-winded answer, but that's sort of how I got there. But for my first 17 months, I was an intern, which I think maybe like the longest tenured intern. But I was at that point, I was in my senior year. I was 20 hours of an internship, full time class schedule, and a full time cook. So I was working 100 hours a week just on all this stuff. And then I graduated, and then I was just, you know, an intern and a cook for another year.
Well, the thing that sticks out to me about this story is that you're kind of starting to set this tale of, you know, what makes Scott May work now. And you talked about wanting to be able to kind of shake things up and be able to succinct things down. And for me, I understand the terminology of wanting to kind of shake things up. You want to see, to me, that means knowing you, you want to see action. If there's a wrong, you want to make it right. You're not just going around shaking trees just to like make the apples fall. Like
I'm far too lazy for that.
You like, the story is kind of starting to talk about how you like to meet people, how you like to understand them and kind of make things better and kind of easier for everybody all together collectively, which is a really big task for especially things like when you're in the Capitol and things are very complex and it's a large moving machine with very just doesn't make sense that these things are going together. They're working against each other. And so that's the thing that I find so interesting about what you eventually brought to the brewery.
Yeah.
So when you left the state capitol, like you said, it was kind of during the COVID time, and you did that primarily because we had a young son.
Yeah.
He was about a year old at the time and daycares and stuff were shutting down. And I was working, you know, full time and had healthcare and stuff. So you became a stay at home dad.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Always try to date ladies with master's degrees. For real.
It worked out really well. You're a really good dad. So then, but then this point, I think you really liked that. I think you really liked being a stay at home dad. It was hard.
It was hard.
The pandemic.
Oh yeah, it was hard. It was the pandemic. Like you couldn't, but the thing about being a stay at home dad that I loved is, you watch this kid basically, go from not being able to move around a whole heck of a lot to like, next thing you know, he's like, yeah, trying to throw himself down the stairs. You kind of got you're always into something. You're always doing something, whether it's putting them in like the stroller to go to walk down to the park or just watching them develop like how to crawl and then how to start walking, the first words they start saying, or just like playing with like little baby's toys was actually kind of cool. Like, cause they're so wacky and so out there. We had this like little table that had these buttons on it. And one of the buttons were all supposed to make sounds for like different animals. But I don't think anyone knows like what a chameleon makes or like an iguana. It was one of the two. And when you push it, it was just like, wabagaba. And it's like, I'm pretty sure that's not what an iguana sounds like. But it was so much fun. I just enjoyed it, you know?
I'm trying to set up the like this tier, this boundary of like, Scott May, comes to the New Glarus Brewing Company. And then there you come in with the iguana noises. And so now I got to pull it back again. So that was a really good time. I have to say, I remember Teddy was really good at convincing you to take him out for donuts and things like that, which was always really nice.
Yeah, dun-duns.
Dun-duns, what he called it.
That was his word. We go to Dunkin' Donuts every day.
So then what makes you want to leave Dun-Duns and iguana noises to, come do something at the New Glarus Brewing Company? Like what was that story or the thing that pulled you in at that point?
Well, and this kind of goes back to my time in the Capitol too. I make no secret about it. I worked for Democrats my entire career, very liberal Democrats out of Milwaukee for the most part. And they were great people, especially Senator Chris Larson. If you are unfamiliar with him, check him out. He's a guy who's doing it for the right reasons, right? He enjoys the fight and he enjoys getting the ball moved a little bit forward. However, though, when I first came into the Capitol, it was after the big Republican sweep. That was the election cycle I worked. My assembly candidate won his election that I worked on in 2010, but it was one of like very, very few who did. So when I was in the Capitol, we were just in a steep, steep minority. Like we could not enact policy to save our lives.
You
like,
were so exhausted when you came home.
It was just running into walls.
Yeah.
And I always say like, if you're in a position like that, and you're in one of those offices, whether you're an elected official or whether you're a staffer, if you're just sort of clocking in and waiting for your vested pension and then waiting for it to multiply. And, if you're in it for those reasons and you're no longer sort of in it for the fight, it's time to leave. It's time to get out. It's time to give somebody fresh a good shot because you become a little jaded. And I'd become a little jaded, And so when Deb approached me to come to work at the brewery, it wasn't anything for the beer side. It wasn't anything for the communication side. I don't think I would have jumped at that point, to tell you the truth, because I'd so burnt out on it, right? Like, you basically forbade me from having a Facebook account anymore. You know, you did.
Riled up.
I know. Well, you did, because I was just in it all the time. And because you kind of have to be. But she approached me because they had been doing charitable giving for so long, and the word would get out, like, yeah, if you ask the brewery and it's something important, they'll probably give you a donation. But once the word gets out on something like that over the course of some years, it becomes like a fire hose, right? You don't know every organization. If you're running a brewery, you don't know who's a good player in nonprofits, or how to even look if someone's, you know, allocating their funds in a responsible way. But because of my experience in the Capitol, I had a working knowledge of the problems of the state, and I had a working knowledge of the groups that were working to try to fix those problems. And when Deb approached me to help, at first it was just, would you come help organize our nonprofit charitable giving committee? And I was like, 100%, yeah, I will do that. And, you know, we came up with a very good organization that does not really allow for any one person to have sort of autonomous control over it, which I really like. And but that was the only thing that would bring me out to something where I could go feel like I was helping in a little bit to solve problems. First, helping the family, Dan and Deb and you guys, you needed someone to do this work. I had the skill set to do it. And two, it was work that could ultimately get me away from the intense fun I was having being a stay-at-home dad. And you know, that's what really brought me out of my semi-retirement, I guess.
Well, there's two thoughts that you brought up in there that I would like to dive into a little bit more. First off is this idea of, you know, being able to help people. So I just kind of want to share a little story. When we were first starting to date, I think we had, you know, said, oh yeah, let's, you know, go out for dinner downtown or something, because you would get done at the Capitol and you'd be downtown Friday night and there's good energy on a summer night. So I came and met you, and but you had to be there when the office was open. You were like the lowest on the totem pole.
Yeah, so like, it was a Friday, so like the chief is out by like 3:30.
But I remember you saying, like, my boss calls me like to check to make sure he's going to call me at like 5:15 or whatever to like make sure that I'm here on Friday night.
Worst.
So like I have to stay here.
Be like, oh, hey, is anything going on? It's like, I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing. Nothing is going on. It's 4:55 on a Friday. You know that. I know that.
So I came to meet you in your office and you were kind of showing me around.
That wasn't Chris Larson, by the way.
You were showing me around. You had a window that overlooked Martin Luther King, and the phone rang. Yeah. And so you picked it up, and you ended up getting into this kind of longer conversation with this little old lady who was worried because her she couldn't pay her electricity bill or something along those lines, and it was getting really hot.
It's a common problem on the south side of Milwaukee.
Yeah, and so you were on the phone with her, like walking her through trying to get her information, and then walking through like, okay, these are the steps we're going to have to take, and these are the people we can reach out to, and these are your tools. And when you got off the phone, you were so smiley, and I knew part of it was because you got to kind of show off in front of your, you know, potential girlfriend. But I think that actually like lights you up. Like those small instances were the things that kind of kept you going. So I'm glad that you're able to kind of carry that through now. But the other part of that, and this is kind of the juxtaposition that I feel like is so hard for the type of work that you do, you have to have that side. You have to have that empathetic, caring, willing to listen to people, you know, just their words.
Yeah.
And then also understand this very complicated machine, because people can think, you know, for the Giving Foundation, oh, you just give money. Like you guys just meet, you look at the applications, and then you just start throwing out checks.
Yeah.
But there's a lot that goes into it. You know, the legalese, the kind of bill signing of it, getting your stuff set up for, you know, what is it? The
501c3.
There we go. Yeah. See, I don't even know what it is.
Oh yeah. When you do over a decade in the Capitol, you can legitimately speak in acronyms, and there'll be acronyms I don't even know. And then I'll hear them and I'll be like, give me 2 seconds and I'll be like, the American Association of the blah, 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 and I'll get it right.
Well, this is the thing. It's because you have this background of understanding how does the rubber hit the road? Because oftentimes it's not just, can I give you money? There's a ton of very in-depth regulated steps that have to happen. And there's a lot of people that want to do good that either don't have the time or knowledge to be able to go through those steps.
Well, yeah. And I, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I don't even play one on television. So, you know, at the time we were setting up, we're very fortunate, you know, that our in-house counsel had a lot of knowledge in this stuff. But that being said, I was able to sort of talk with him and be like, this is how, you know, I think we should set this up and work with him very closely on how we wanted to organize our structure, how we wanted, you know, the money to sort of flow, how we wanted, you know, ultimate responsibilities to be sort of, you know, assigned. And one of the things I'm very proud of is it's very, very rare for, you know, an organization to submit their 501c3 application and not have to clarify anything and not get a letter back like 9 months later from the IRS, basically saying like, you need to either, you need to redo this part, or you need to expound on that part. Like, it's very rare for an application to get approved on the first sort of go around. And the way they get, the way they let organizations operate is once you've applied, you can sort of operate as a 501c3 while the application process is going on. But we applied and we got our 501c3 status on the first go. And I was just very shocked and excited about that because it was like, I think the employee, the team meeting was coming up for that year. And, you know, I was kind of struggling. What am I going to present? And I was like, oh, this is a bit of good news. Like, first try, guys, we got our 501c3 status. We are now a legitimate, recognized by the IRS, charitable giving foundation. And, yeah, they signed off on it like right away. And we were able to very quickly establish the system, and within that framework, very quickly able to establish partner relationships with some of the best organizations around the state doing work in healthcare, specifically mental health care, housing, domestic violence, emergency sheltering, food insecurity, a little bit into land conservation and veterans issues. We are very quickly, because of that status and because of the organization we had, very quickly able to demonstrate to these organizations that this was indeed a serious formalization of our charitable giving efforts.
You guys are starting to get a pretty big name for being known in the community and kind of Wisconsin wide for being able to kind of set up good standards for being able to give. Because again, it's not just, I'm just throwing money at you.
No, it's gotta be very deliberate. One of the things I'm very serious about, and this came up not too long ago with you know, a request we had had that I ultimately had to say no to at the level they were you know requesting, but then it caused like a bit of a whatever because you know people can kind of
small town
people can kind of get their feelings hurt, and then you know you hear like you know oh so and so said X or so and so said Y. And so then someone asked for like another meeting. And what I ultimately had to tell
them to the politics, well, the politics side of it.
Yeah. And what I ultimately, I had a very good conversation, but what I told them is like, look, we have set out our you know, our priorities and you know, that isn't saying, you know, this is a reason why we'll always say no to something like this. It gives us a reason to, we can get to a yes, but what I can't do is ever set up a situation where people feel like they can, you know, they can put something out there and I will feel so much pressure that then I will then cave and give, because this giving foundation is important, not only to the brewery, but to the community. And it is a font of goodwill for us. And it's something we're very, very proud of. But for me personally, there's an intense responsibility I feel as a steward of this endowment. You know, I can't ever get myself into a position where I'm feeling like I am giving for the wrong reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's something I take very, very seriously. Like being this, you know, this brewery's my family and they've even placed their trust in me. They've placed their loyalty in me. I'm not going to mess around with that, you know?
Well, this was one of the questions I was going to ask, because when you were talking about the path, it was you know, stay-at-home dad, and then Deb comes to ask you to do this, but there's these, like, there are these minutia steps that happened before that, which, you know, I get to see, and it would be hard to, you know, quantify, like, on a bullet point or on a resume or something. But when our family would get together, I'm not a super big talker, and my mom, especially Deb, you know, is very interested in politics and kind of understanding how things work. And you, you know, working in the Capitol, had a ton of knowledge on that. And so when we would get together at the dinner table, it would be either, you know, you and my dad talking about beer, or you and my mom talking about, you know, politics or something tangent to that.
Yeah.
And then I would just kind of like sit there and hang out and listen to all of that. And so that was the thing that I always thought was interesting, is that when you and Deb spoke, it was almost like sounding boards of each other, that, you know, you could give that in more in-depth behind the scenes insight into mm-hmm. what was actually happening for Deb's sort of questions. And I remember small little instances where, you know, Deb say, well, what is your opinion on this? You guys kind of, it was almost like a little trial period where you guys got to kind of understand what was so important to each other and kind of how your mind works. And I think that's why it ends up being such a good fit for things like the Giving Foundation. It might be easy for somebody on the outside to say, oh, you know, they gave it to Scott May, the son-in-law.
Oh, the son-in-law with his nepo job.
But
I bet he's enjoying his life.
Yeah. You know, we've already gone over the education and the experience and et cetera. But also, there is this kind of trust that forms, you know, this this understanding, you know, you understand what is important to Deb. In a lot of ways, those things that are important often align, and you guys understand each other. So there's this sense of kind of, you know, understanding, and like you said, the extra layer of responsibility, which I very much empathize with as well, of, you know, making sure that this is, you know, done right and properly. Because, you know, you're not going to go home over Christmas break and, you know, not have to, you know what I mean? Not like, you're not just going to like clock out and then be done with it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you know, And it's kind of funny in that, you know, getting, you know, thinking about my position and what I, you know, what I do, I've never felt sort of sensitive about like the, oh, he's the son-in-law and now he gets a job, because, well, hey, this place isn't just lousy with carries. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I think there's two family members outside of your mom and dad who work here. And it was sort of like one of those things where it's like, well, I guess if they just wanted to give their son-in-law.
That would be us, by the way.
Yeah, that'd be us. If they just want to give their son-in-law a job, they probably would have done so, you know, like 10 years ago, I guess. So it made sense to me in the way that the need that they had fit the skill set I had. And it just was a timing issue of like, no, this works out where I can do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think I can do it well. And I think it'll excite me. And one of the things I wanted, you know, because like I said, I was really enjoying my time as a stay-at-home dad. So I, you know, I don't think I ever asked about salary. I don't think I ever asked about benefits. I don't think I ever asked about all the stuff someone would ask for going into a new job. The only thing I quote unquote negotiated over, I think, was like, you know, I want to make my own schedule, because my parents did a great job, but we were, you know, working class people. My dad ran a printing press at a, you know, at a business forms factory. And my mom, like I said, was a registered nurse. So, you know, I was a latchkey kid for most of my youth. I would come home starting probably in first or second grade or whatever, whenever you stop having babies. It was the 90s. So I think it was probably like third or fourth grade. Like, you know, whenever you stop having babysitters, you know, you come home and it's just like, all right, what's on MTV or whatever. And then your folks come home 2-3 hours later. Right. And, you know, I remember that, and there's a lot of freedom in that, but I also wanted, you know, I want to be home for my kid to get off the bus. You know what I mean? I want to be home to go pick him up from school. I want to be home in the morning to make him breakfast and to do stuff like that. And if I was working in the Capitol or something like that, I largely would miss all that stuff. So that's like really the only, I guess, ask I had was like, I really wanted to be a, you know, where I can make my schedule and do stuff. Everything else, it was just like, I would do this on the humble for them. You know what I mean? Like, I would do this for free for them. This is the stuff I enjoy doing. Yeah. This is the stuff I like to do. You know?
You are really good at it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, bringing up the family portion of it, that is a very big side of it. And, do you want to talk a little bit about, like, if we can step back again to when we met? When we first met, I don't know how long it was, but I never really talked about the brewery and kind of who I, you know, my history. And
well, you'd come back from Montana like a couple years earlier, right? Maybe 1 or 2 years earlier.
I was
working
at an architecture firm in Madison.
Yeah. So
at the time.
I would have to imagine like Montana, you probably had a little bit of an anonymity with it, with like dating people, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like you could say, oh yeah, my parents operate.
I can honestly say I had no time for dating when I came back.
But if you did, like, so, you know, but in Wisconsin, you meet a person, right? And you're trying to establish, do I like this person? You don't want to lead with like, oh yeah, you know that brewery that sells the most, you know, beer in the state? Yeah, that's my parents. You know what I mean? I feel like it probably, you know, for you, it might be uncomfortable. But also too, I'm a very aloof person. Like I you know, the way my brain operates, the way I am, like I tend to only pay attention to the things that are like interesting me at the time. And I remember I was in the kitchen of your apartment, and we'd been probably dating for like 3 or 4 weeks at that point, right? Something like that. And I came in and you said, oh, do you want a beer? And I said, yeah. And because I never turn down a beer or a sandwich. Those are two things I will take from you. And you were taking off your jacket, and I noticed it was like a Dickies Eisenhower kind of style jacket, and it had the spotted cow patch on one side. I said, Kate, on the other side. And I said, oh, where'd you get that jacket? And you're like, oh, they give it to the employees. I said, oh, I thought you were an architect. You're like, oh, I am now. I worked there. And I was like, oh, when did you start working there? And you're like, when I was 9. And I was like, oh, okay. And like, I didn't ask a single follow-up question to that. Like, it never occurred to me to be like, that's an odd thing for a person to say. I wonder how that came up. Because frankly, I wasn't interested in your...
You just wanted to drink the beer and
your
have
work
some dinner.
I was interested in getting to know you and then drinking the beer and hanging out and having a good time. But yeah, if I was a more astute person, I probably would have put it together a lot sooner. And I remember when you told me, I think we've been dating like for a while, when you finally told me, I was like, really? And you're like, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool.
You say that you never turned down a beer, but there is a small tangent story in here of a time that Scott May did turn down a beer. And do you want to tell the story?
Oh yeah, I have this weird thing, and I don't tend to recognize the meaning of people. You know what I mean? Like in the moment, like I was at a Democratic thing trying to get a job. Right. And I was drinking beer all night with this guy, and I never recognized he was like, you know, the guy who could get me a job. I was just shooting the bull with him. It didn't even occur to me. And then he's like, oh, you should give this kid a job at the end of the night. So the first time I really have like a full one-on-one conversation with your dad, I had met him and your mom together. We had gone out to dinner to introduce. I think that was like the only other time I'd met these people.
I don't know if that's true, but it might have been close.
Might have been close. And I was going to ask him if I could marry you. And I remember I like called him and I was like, can I come down and talk to you? And he was like, yeah. So I'm nervous, right?
Because we had an apartment
separate apartments
up in Madison. And then Dan and Deb were living in
New Glarus.
Yeah.
So the whole time I'm driving down, and when I get nervous, I just like whatever is around me, I'll consume it. Like that is just what it is.
Giant bottle of
water. So I
have
this giant bottle of water in the car. So I'm like chugging this bottle of water on the way down. They're not thinking, just like chugging, chugging, chugging. I get down there and I pull up to the house right next to the brewery. And so I'm like, well, this is a little intimidating all of a sudden. It was like the one time in my life, like you couldn't uncontextualize the moment. You know what I mean? So I sit down and I'm talking with your dad for like 20 minutes or so. And this is how I know your parents are just like down to earth, like cool people from like working sort of class stock, like that they have that in their background. Because, you know, my life story isn't exactly like, you know, oh yeah, no, this is totally a dude who should be asking to marry my daughter like 7 months after meeting her. You know what I mean? But like, he asked me a couple of questions, like, you know, questions about stuff. I think like, you know, I had recently been through a divorce like before that, you know, and like I had, you know, it took me a while to get through college, like, but I did have this job at the Capitol, right? So like I had some good stuff going for me, but he was like totally cool. He asked me a few questions about that stuff. And then he was just like, and I think it's a testament to like how much they trust you and your opinion and your assessment of things, because like, I think he had like three follow-up questions for me. Then he's like, yeah, of course you can marry, ask my daughter to marry you. I think that would be great. We're totally on board with that. But during the time we were talking, like I had to pee like really bad, like the whole time. And it was getting like emergent, you know, by the end of this conversation. And, you know, like a dumbass, I didn't just go, hey, can I use your bathroom real quick? You know, cause that's what normal people would probably do. And then he goes, okay, I have some beer here in my personal fridge
beer fridge
that, you know, it's whatever stuff I've been saving. You can have your pick. Do you want to have a beer with me? And I looked this dude dead ass in his eyes and I said, no, I gotta go. And then I left. Like that was it. I just said, no, I gotta go. Thank you. Shook his hand and left so I could go to the Culver's and pee. And then I'm telling you this story on the way back and you're like, and this is again, getting back to like how I just don't sort of put these things together in the moment. Like to me, this seemed like a perfectly normal thing to do. Right. But then you were like, my dad, the brewmaster of New Glarus Brewing, asked you to have a beer with him after asking his daughter for his hand in marriage. And you just said no and left. And I was like, yeah, like, but he said yes. Like I was really stoked and happy. And you were like, all right, you're going to have a beer with that guy at some point.
It worked out pretty good though. I've
had a few with them now.
Yeah. That is the thing that I think is so great. And I think that's actually how this podcast, you know, we haven't talked about this,
no.
But you know, we've talked about the Giving Foundation, but then there's also this other part of it of, you know, you help with like some press releases and things.
Yeah,
along those
I do
lines.
A lot of the communications stuff now and this. Yeah.
But then the podcast was kind of this like weird grass movements sort of a thing. And I think this is kind of how it started up. You know, you and my dad have always been, you know, we'll meet for dinner or, you know, we're hanging out with the kid or we're having a family vacation or something like that. You guys are just always have this kind of cadence with each other. And I feel like that's kind of how the podcast kind of came to be.
Yeah. Well, we were in Door County and I think we go up to we like to go to Sister Bay because they have a pizza joint there right next to like a beach, right? And a lake and a park.
Oh, yeah.
Like
you can get the like pizza to go.
Yeah, so if you get the pizza to go, you can just sit on like, you sit at one of the picnic tables there and you got a good view of Lake Michigan. And then for the kid, there's like a playground and a beach like right there. So it's like perfect. Teddy can go run around and then come back and go, I want pizza. And then take a bite of pizza and then, you know, go do his Teddy thing, just getting all his energy out. But me and your dad were just sitting there. I think something that happened in the beer, like it's always what happens. Something happens in the beer world, you know, or, you know, a beer's coming out or we're just drinking a beer and we just start talking about this stuff. And then I'm always like kind of Joe Sixpack with it because I don't know any of this stuff. Or if I do know it, I it just gets pushed from the top of my head. So I'm always very curious to hear what your dad has to say about this stuff. And I remember after that meal and after we had like a, probably like a 20 or 30 minute conversation just surrounding something that had happened in the beer world. We were like walking back to the car and we were going back to the spot to pack up and leave like the next day. And then your mom said, hey, would you like to do a podcast for us with Dan? And you guys can talk like this and we can see if that would work out as an interesting way for us to sort of tell our stories and just talk about Dan's life and what it's like to be a brewmaster. And I just said, yes, I was like, yeah, I want to do that. And I think it was like a good perfect timing thing. Cause like I had said before, you know, by the time I was leaving the Capitol, you were banning me from social media. You were like, this guy cannot think about messaging anymore. He cannot think about the angles on a story anymore. He cannot, like, he is burnt out. He cannot do this stuff anymore. But by that point I'd been working at the foundation for like a year or so. I'd been doing that work and I'd been writing. I'd continued writing cause I'd always written my fiction and things like that for myself. So the my tools were still sharp in communications, but if she had asked me like even 7 months before that, I probably would have said no, or, you know, but it was just one of those things where I was like, I was ready to start diving back into doing more communications work and ready to start diving back into to thinking more about like, well, we don't want to advertise. We don't do that. We want to get our message out when we have to. How do we do that? How do we sort of angle for that sort of stuff? And what was, you know, what came of it was this podcast, but then also like a, you know, sort of a revamping of how we do our media outreach and stuff like that. Cause we're, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to go around just paying for like a bunch of advertising and stuff like that. People know who we are, but when we do something interesting, like build a CO2 machine to recapture all of our CO2, so we're not emitting CO2 into the atmosphere and then reusing it for our brewing process, you know, that's an interesting story. So then I was able to start writing press releases that would get those sort of stories that we want to get out there, you know, and that's been a lot of fun.
Well, when she asked you this, what did you want the podcast to be? And do you think it's kind of evolved since then?
Yeah. I didn't know what I wanted it to be. I knew it was just going to be me and Dan sitting in a room for the most part. Right. But I knew what I didn't want it to be. And I didn't want it to be a half an hour advertisement for the brewery. Yeah. You know, at its core, you're producing a podcast for a private business, right? Like, yeah. At its core, you're going to be talking about that business. You're going to be talking about the products that business puts out. You're going to be talking about the beer that business makes. That can all come off as, you know, false. That can all come off as disingenuous. That can all come off as like, I am trying to sell you Spotted Cow right now. You're aware of it and I'm aware of it. And I'm putting on my, hey guys, I'm cracking a Spotted Cow right now. Look at the hell. You know what I mean? I didn't want it to be that. I wanted it to, because when this stuff works best and when me and your dad work best is when we're just talking about stuff that we're both sort of interested in, you know, and that's what I want. I wanted a platform for your dad who has 40 years of brewing history in his head to talk about that brewing history, 40 years of technical knowledge in his head to talk about that technical knowledge. Because he is a very engaged speaker on this stuff. And he's one of, you know, he probably wouldn't get up on a podium and say it, but he's probably one of the foremost experts when it comes to brewing beer in the United States right now. I mean, he just is. You know what I mean? You don't get to this level of success that he has without being that sort of just undeniably good at what you do. And I don't think, and I think for your parents, they've never really felt like they had a proper vehicle for him to just get that out there or feel like he had an outlet to talk about that stuff. So that's what I wanted to help them create.
Yeah. Well, it's not in his, I don't think it's generally in his nature to be talkative. I think me and my dad are kind of the same in that regards that, you know, we want to work towards our goal. We want to do it to the best of our ability. And we just kind of want to keep things moving. But then you, like you said, you know, over more than 40 years of experience for him and all the things that he's done and he's learned, being able to kind of talk about it with somebody like you, it's very personable. People, you know, stop me when I'm out and about. Oh, I listen to the podcast. I love it so much. You know, they sound so great together. So you guys both are doing a really excellent job at that. But I want to ask, for the podcast, there is this point where you were just starting, you know. Like you're getting the mixing equipment.
Well, I think like episode two is still like sound. I think it's still like very quiet. Like I had to like salvage episode two. And I think if you like go back in the podcast and you listen to like, I think it was one with Sam Bennett, like that early one. I think it was like, so, and now we're going to, I couldn't figure out like I did something wrong, but then I didn't want to like, just be, I wasn't confident enough to be like, hey, we need to re-record this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it was like a grassroots movement for you guys. I think you and Dan both kind of came together to say, like, what do we want this to be? And then you had the technical side of it and, you know, getting the mixing board and, oh, this cord doesn't plug into here and et cetera. I think one time something didn't record and then you had to ask my dad to record again, which just kills you.
Oh yeah.
And then you found out it was something stupid. Like one of the buttons was like a little too high up or something like that.
Well, no, what had happened somehow my mixing board got moved and one of the wires came loose, but it came just loose enough to like register, but not tight enough to actually record anything.
So what has the podcast kind of come over time? I have to be honest, I should, but I have not listened to all of them. And, you know, in actuality, because it's a lot like kind of hearing about your life. But I love hearing you talk to the employees, you know, Scott Noll and Sam and Randy and everybody. And so what has the podcast kind of become since then? Has it gone the direction you want? Are you getting kind of the response you want? Like, do you get to talk to the people after this?
I always consider it very fortunate when I don't get to see the response to a lot of things. You know what I mean? Because it's just, back to my literature degree, when I was first studying literary criticism, right? How do you decipher what a story is saying? How do you interpret what a story is saying? One of the first things they told us was basically the author's intent on this thing does not matter to you. What they think it is, what they thought they were doing, what they've said this is about, it does not matter. What matters is how you dissect it, how you interpret it, because ultimately it's an exercise in communication. The author's trying to take something from their brain and put it in your brain, and how successful they are is largely how you interpret it, you know? So I like to divorce myself once something's sort of out there. That being said, I, you know, like anyone else, I, you know, and I only have access to like basically Apple Podcasts on my phone. So I can look and see like what people have like clicked the stars. Like when I go through to download the episode, or it automatically downloads the episode. When I go to listen to it, I see what the star rating is. I think it's seen like a 4.5 out of 5. So I'm feeling good at that. But then I read the comments one time and someone was like, Scott's giggling is very distracting. And then like for like 3 episodes, I was like very cognizant of it. And then you just have to come to the decision like, I'm a stone weirdo, man. Like I, the way I am is just the way I am. If Dan says something funny and I do my silly little high pitched giggle, like I'm not editing that out. Like that was a sincere reaction. And if it's distracting, well, I'm sorry.
Killjoy.
I know. Like your laughter angers me.
Yeah, you're right. Just stay off the.
But then, like Dan and Deb will ask, like, "How is it going? What's the response?" And I'll take a look, and I'll be like, "Well, the metric I can use that you know through Buzzsprout and other things is how many people are downloading it every week, and you know, in our new episodes. I mean, we'll average you know about 9 to 1,000 downloads an episode, 900 to 1,000, sometimes a little bit more downloads an episode. It's what it sort of averages out to when it crawls up over the course of some weeks, and every week we get like 700 to 800 fresh new downloads. So I don't know. It seems to be doing pretty well for like a podcast based about a brewery that only sells beer in one state. Like I think that's doing pretty okay.
Yeah. No, I've been getting lots of good feedback about it. I really enjoyed being here doing this with you today. We'll see what sort of feedback we get from this. There's more stories about Scott May that I'd love to come back and be able to share with you guys. Is there anything else you wanted to share? Any favorite memories from the brewery or anything else you want to share about the podcast before we close out? Something I might have missed on.
Well, one of my favorite things about this brewery, you know, just in general, and I, even though I'm now working here and doing this podcast and doing the foundation stuff, I'm siloed basically, right? I got very specialized skills, right? So like I often joke with Scott, I'm like, yeah, employee evaluations are coming out. He's like, yeah, you don't even have a team lead, Scott. Like you're your department. So like, how do you think you're doing? But being able to look at it from sort of an outsider's perspective and not really, I'm in it, but like I can still have that little outsider's perspective on it. And just coming up to the hilltop when I'm up there to do foundation work. And then, you know, if I have a day where, you know, I'm getting out at like 4:30 or whatever, just getting my shifty, like when I was a cook, just going to the bar and getting my shifty and like talking to Kieran or Craig or, you know, Jen up there and just
shifty is your free beer.
Yeah. My free beer
after working from the taps.
Like I said, man, like, you know, they're offering, I'm going to take it. And, you know, I shooting the bull with them for a couple minutes while looking out the windows at the woods out here, or like, if I don't feel like talking to anybody, cause I've been doing this for a while, like just grabbing my beer and going out back to the beer patio, the beer garden out there, and just finding like the most isolated seat I can find. That's like staring at the Wisconsin farmlands. Yeah, yeah. Like that to me is just, you know, that's what this brewery is. You know, it's making it, it's really a commitment to an ethos of doing the best work you can in the best place you can. And I just dig it. I really do. I have a love for it.
Well, cheers to that.
If I didn't, I wouldn't say I did.
Well, cheers to that. Thanks so much for letting me do this with you, Scott.
Thanks. Love you.
Love you too.